Good evening, and welcome to Local Motion, where we go in-depth with local public affairs from around the KVNF listening area. I'm Patricia Naft. Today on the show, we'll be showcasing the regional reporting done by the KVNF news team. There are 198 all-volunteer fire departments in Colorado that serve about half the state's population. And a recent report compiled by Rocky Mountain PBS iNews found that many of those operations are seriously understaffed. KVNF's Laura Pomisano visited two Delta County volunteer fire departments and found they depend on each other.
Matthew Van Vliet has been volunteering with the Paonia Fire Department for 7 years. When he's not at the fire station or at his paying job, he also volunteers as an emergency responder for the local ambulance association.
It's hard to balance it. I know I have about 15-hour shifts at the coal mine, and I only work 14 days out of the month. So the other 14 days, I'm trying to balance it with honeydews and kids. I have 4 kids. Volunteer, you need to put your effort into it, and it takes a very giving wife to allow so much time.
Van Vliet's older brother also volunteers for Paonia Fire. The department has 26 volunteers, but it's still short 2 crew members. 30 miles away in Cedar Edge, it's the same story.
That's what it sounds like when we have to go out.
That's Cedar Edge Fire Chief Kevin Walker. He says it's been hard to recruit young people in recent years. The area's struggling economy means more people are having to spend more time trying to make ends meet.
Commitment is huge. Everybody has a full-time job. They're trying to make a life somewhere else, make their living, take care of their family, everything involved, and that comes to a screeching halt every time the pager goes off.
And Walker says it takes a lot more time to volunteer than most people realize.
Most people don't see what really goes on in the fire department. They see the trucks drive down the road fast. They don't see that an hour fire takes 3 hours to clean up when you get back to restock the trucks, to put them back together, all the work that goes in behind the scenes.
Paonia and Cedar Edge are not alone. Nationwide, volunteer fire departments are facing shortages. And according to data compiled by Rocky Mountain PBS iNews, Colorado needs an additional 3,500 volunteer firefighters. That means the state only has about half of the volunteers it needs. The Cedar Edge fire crew says they give their time because they want to help others, and they love being part of the fire community.
There's 5 of us that are family that are on the fire department.
What is your relation to everyone?
Rob and Wayne are my in-laws, my sister-in-law and brother-in-law, and Eli is my brother, and Brian's my son-in-law.
That's Don Leon. He's been a volunteer for the Cedar Edge Fire Department for 22 years. Robin Melson is Leon's sister-in-law. In addition to Melson and her husband, her father also used to volunteer for the department. Melson says she was raised in this community.
It's a family. I mean, you're all a family, and you all cry together, you all laugh together. It's a family that's not like any other family, and there's a certain amount of closeness, and if one thing affects you, it affects you all. And it's probably the best family you could ever have.
Cedar Edge Fire Chief Kevin Walker says there may be shortages from one department to another, but all of them work together.
We're all a big family, whether you're from Cedar Edge, Paonia, Hotchkiss, Delta. We work together on calls, off calls. That's the fire service nationwide.
For KVNF, I'm Laura Pomisano.
Earlier this year, conservationists, students, and volunteers spread out across the North Fork area, going from house to house, collecting water samples. It's the first testing and will continue to happen over the coming years. KVNF's Jake Ryan found out why.
I'm standing with a few other people on a back porch of a home outside of Paonia. The North Fork of the Gunnison is right behind us.
We're going to have to purge the well. And what that means is that we are getting any water that's been sitting in the well out of it and getting a fresh sample from the aquifer that we're going to let it run. Michelle's going to water the lawn or the flowers or the garden. And then after we've done that, we're going to take our water samples.
That's Katja Hafich. She's a grad student from University of Colorado Boulder and part of QUIRC, a water research center. They're testing 10 wells today to get baseline water samples. With proposed oil and gas development not too far away, Quirk and the Conservation Center teamed up to see where things stand now. That way, they hope to be able to scientifically look at any changes that might happen to the water quality.
So these are, this is what comes from the lab. And there's 11 bottles in here for different tests that the lab does. And if you were to do this as a private, you know, as a well user, what you would get is a cooler, this bag of samples, a chain of custody, a list of what the different bottles are, but no instructions on how to collect the samples.
They're testing for a wide range of stuff that could be contaminating the well, from methane to volatile organic compounds like benzene. Once the 11 bottles are filled, the biggest stakeholder in this particular test, the homeowner, Michelle Miller, has a few questions.
Tell me this, Katya, but how long approximately does it take to get the results back?
So we should get the results back from the lab in 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
And we'll send, yeah, and then we give ourselves 2 months to get back to you, so with the interpretation guide and the interpretation.
Yeah.
Miller definitely appreciates how important her water is.
We drink our water, we use it for watering, we use it for washing, and I'm hoping that our water is, I'm hoping that it will verify that it's pretty good right now, and hopefully we can take measures to keep it that way.
But she says that really, it's just an assumption.
This assumption that your water is good, and that there's no problem with it, and that you're taken care of, and it's really scary to think that it may not be.
CU Boulder and the Conservation Center plan to keep testing the same wells ever so often to be able to pick up on any changes. For KVNF, I'm Jake Ryan.
Over the past decade, a tiny insect has been causing a big problem in southwest Colorado, and it's getting worse. The beetle is devouring mature spruce trees and turning them into expanses primed for wildfire. The U.S. Forest Service recently unveiled a broad new plan to try to minimize fire danger, but not everyone thinks it's the best path forward. Laura Pomisano reports.
I'm standing in the forest outside of Lake City, the only town in Colorado's Hinsdale County. The county is about the size of Rhode Island, and 95% of the land here is federally owned. It's thick with trees, but almost all of them are dying.
Look at how that tree is starting to lose some of its needles. We're going to take a look at that one right back there.
Roy Mask is an entomologist, meaning he studies bugs for the U.S. Forest Service.
The genus is Dendroctonus. The species is Rupipennis. That genus name means tree killer.
Mask is talking about spruce beetles. Their habitat ranges from Alaska to Arizona, and they're about the size of a grain of rice. These insects are feasting on Engelmann spruce here in Hinsdale County. Mask is cutting some bark off a dying tree.
Here are some of the adult beetles. So you can see the female makes a gallery. She lays her eggs. The larvae radiate away from those egg galleries. And they basically just kind of create a roadmap of feeding. This would normally be a living layer of the tree. And so they're basically killing that living layer. We call it the inner bark.
These insects, which are native to the area, can destroy a healthy forest within 3 years. They can fly and also travel on windstorms, where they rain down onto new trees. Mask says spruce beetle populations are flourishing in Colorado because of warming temperatures and drought conditions.
There are literally millions of acres in the West that are susceptible to beetles, and we could talk about a number of different beetles, not just spruce beetle. And so as we look across these vast landscapes and we look at their susceptibility, the likelihood of change and disturbance is there.
Federal officials in the Grand Mesa, Uncompahgre, and Gunnison National Forests in southwest Colorado are proposing a 10-year project to try and get rid of 250,000 acres of dead spruce trees. In the same plan, the Forest Service also wants to treat an additional 230,000 acres of aspen forests that have experienced dieback from drought and fungus. Normally, plans like this deal with small areas, but because of the size of the problem, they want to fight it on a large scale.
We support their efforts, having experienced two catastrophic wildfires in 2012 and 2013. We see the damage that is happening because of spruce beetle kill.
That's Hinsdale County Commissioner Cindy Dozier. A major Forest Service concern is trees falling onto roads and buildings or fueling wildfires. The proposal would allow for controlled burns to clear and revitalize dead stands, replanting, and timber contracts with logging companies to remove dead trees. Dozier says she's urging the Forest Service to act quickly because she thinks the county is a tinderbox waiting to be lit.
A lot of these standing dead trees are lining major roads. To get into Lake City and to get out of Lake City, we have one way, and that is Highway 149. We view it as a beginning of a fire break, but also it's an escape route if we were to have a fire.
But some environmentalists, like Hillary Cooper with the Sheep Mountain Alliance, a Telluride-based conservation group, don't agree with the scale of the plan.
Our concern is that the recent science that is coming out is saying that the more human management and human disturbance that is created in forests actually hurts the efforts of forests to regenerate themselves. So we're trying to find a balance between the economic need to do some of these salvage projects to address public health and safety, which we feel is very important, and then backing them off of some of the areas that we feel should be left to natural regeneration.
The Forest Service has already held several public meetings to get feedback on its plan. Officials say a draft environmental impact statement on the project is set to be released this winter. Back in the mountains above Lake City, Mask, the Forest Service biologist, says spruce beetles won't kill off all of the trees.
There will be young spruce out here. Even in a warming climate, it won't all disappear at one time. So I think people will get used to a much younger forest.
Mask says at this point, spruce beetle populations have grown exponentially and will continue to spread. And all forest managers can do is try and plan ahead. For KVNF, I'm Laura Palmisano.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Local Motion. This week, we're showcasing the regional reporting done by the KVNF News team. Colorado is one of several states that will take up the issue of physician-assisted suicide. The topic is once again in the national spotlight with the recent death of Brittany Maynard. The terminally ill 29-year-old moved to Oregon to take advantage of the state's Death with Dignity law. From the state capitol, Benta Berkland has more.
Oregon voters were the first in the country to pass the Death with Dignity Act. And now, two decades later, about 750 people have taken medication to hasten their deaths, including Brittany Maynard. She explained her decision to CBS News and says she doesn't view it as suicide because cancer is taking her life.
I am choosing to end it a little sooner and in a lot less pain and suffering.
But Peg Sandine says cases such as Maynard's are in the minority.
It's very rarely used.
Sandine heads the Death with Dignity National Center based in Portland, Oregon, which helped pass the initiative. She says there are safeguards in place. A patient must make 3 separate requests to medical officials and go through 2 waiting periods.
Then the person has to be evaluated by 2 different physicians, and both physicians have to determine that the person is terminally ill with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live, and also that the person is mentally competent to make health care decisions.
It's a model that Democratic Representative Lois Court of Denver hopes Colorado can emulate.
I've gotten emails and phone calls from all over the state from people who want the dignity of making this final decision.
Court is using one of her constituents as inspiration for a bill she plans to introduce during the next legislative session.
And he had ALS and he was suffering and he was starting to starve himself to death because he knew he was going to die.
Court was also moved by her own mother's decade-long battle and death from lung disease.
I said to my father, I want to see her. And my father said, no, you don't. You want to remember the mother you had, not what she has deteriorated into.
But the bill will be controversial and face an uphill battle with Republicans in control of the state Senate, where opposition is already building.
There is a significant moral responsibility government has to defend life and to preserve life, and a very dangerous slippery slope when we start dabbling in the, okay, but you can end a life here and you can end a life there.
That's Republican Senator Kevin Lundberg of Berthoud, who will chair the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. He says the proposal forces physicians to violate the oath of do no harm.
This promotes a notion that it's better to be dead. And I don't believe we as humans have that moral authority. I don't want to call it a whim, but on just the basis of this is not something I want to continue to do.
While some individual physicians support the process, the American Medical Association has long opposed physician-assisted suicide. But Peg Sandine with the Death with Dignity National Center says most of the opposition stems from religious objections.
In all of the political campaigns that we have been involved with, about 50% or 60% of the funding from the opposition campaign comes directly from the Catholic Church.
In 2012, the Catholic Church helped defeat a Death with Dignity ballot proposal in Massachusetts. Religious leaders from the Jewish community and other Christian denominations also opposed it. Washington State, Vermont, and Oregon are the only three states in the country with Death with Dignity laws on the books. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
Each year, thousands of Coloradans, men and women, are victims of domestic violence. October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. In recognition of it, KVNF's Laura Pomisano brings us the story of a survivor.
Miriam is 25 years old. Born in Mexico, she came to the U.S. with her parents when she was 11. She lived in Las Vegas before moving to Colorado 2 years ago. She left to escape a man who was abusing her.
When I first met him, he had no job, he had no house, he had no money, and he was on drugs. And when he met me, he knew I had a car, had a good job, and I was doing really good. I had a house. So that's when he first started talking to me. I guess that's when it first started, because he came to me just because I had all those things that he didn't have.
She says her boyfriend Fabio started taking financial advantage of her. Then the situation turned violent.
Physical abuse started whenever I got pregnant, when he found out I was pregnant. He was telling me that it was my fault, that I wasn't taking care of myself, that we didn't need a child because we wasn't going to be able to party or have money to go out, you know? And then he started to hit me and throwing me in the bed and doing the sexual abuse.
Miriam says the violence got so bad, she almost lost her child.
I had a really bad pregnancy, so that's one of the reasons my parents went to visit me, because I was having a surgery and they wanted to see if I was okay, and that's when they found out about domestic violence that I was going through.
Miriam's parents brought her to live with them in western Colorado. After her son was born, she says Fabio started calling her, threatening to take her child away. That's when she decided to seek help. She contacted Hilltop's Tri-County Resource Center. The nonprofit organization provides assistance to victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. It serves Delta, Montrose, and Ouray counties. Amy Guadri Chavez says Tri-County responded to nearly 1,500 crisis calls last year.
We define domestic violence as a pattern of abusive behavior in any relationship that's used by one partner to gain or maintain power and control over another partner.
Guadri Chavez says domestic violence can be physical, sexual, emotional, psychological, and even economic abuse. According to federal data, more than 1 in 3 women and more than 1 in 4 men in the U.S. have experienced some form of physical violence by an intimate partner. According to Colorado data, more than 10,000 domestic violence misdemeanor cases were filed last year. But that's an improvement. Based on a 10-year average, the number of domestic violence misdemeanor cases filed by the state's district courts has dropped nearly 13%. Jesse Cox is the commander of the City of Delta Police Department. Cox teaches a course at the police academy on how to respond to and investigate domestic violence calls. He says it's important for officers to make sure victims feel safe.
You know, it's common for an abusive spouse to say, well, without me, you're not going to have any money, or I'm going to take you off the insurance and the kids won't have insurance, or I'll take the kids away from you.
Cox says it's against the state's victims' rights law for abusers to do those things, but usually victims don't know that.
So using our officers and educating them on victims' rights and utilizing our victim services coordinator, we can really educate them on what's available to them and how we can help them.
Cox says under the Colorado Victim Rights Act, the abusive person can't take away things like housing, transportation, or kids. He says it also puts automatic criminal restraining orders into effect. Miriam, the domestic violence survivor, is grateful for the help she got, but she says she wants people to recognize they have a role to play too.
One day that I was being abused by my boyfriend, he was pulling my hair, getting me out of the car, and he was really, really like pushing me and kicking me and doing all this kind of stuff. And I was calling for help in English and Spanish, and nobody would like to call the police. So I really would like to tell those people out there, if they see a situation like this, that they should call 911 or try to help them, because they could be saving somebody's life.
Miriam has a message for other victims.
Some girls are so scared, especially in the Hispanic culture. Some girls are told that if they go and ask for help, they'll be deported or they'll take their kids away, you know?
Miriam says this isn't true. She says agencies like Tri-County are there to help victims, and they kept her information private.
I really encourage them to go and try to get help for them, especially if they have any kids. I mean, the kids, they need their moms to be okay or their parents to be okay.
Miriam is now in a transitional home and plans to start taking college classes soon. She says she hopes to someday help other victims of domestic violence and be a role model for her son. For KVNF, I'm Laura Palmisano.
With pushes for greener technology and scientific advancements, the future of America's electricity is changing. The next generation of Americans might see a different world of energy creation. KVNF's Jake Ryan talks with some students who might be part of this shifting future.
It's a hot and sunny day outside of Paonia, which is appropriate.
This is our lab for adult.
I'm at Solar Energy International, a nonprofit that educates people from around the world about solar and teaches them how to install it. Today, though, eighth graders are coming from the area to learn about solar energy. Andrea Wang is with SEI and works on education outreach.
I feel it's important. We're in this community. SEI is a school. We're working with adults, but we want to provide the opportunity for kids here to learn about this technology and become aware of it, more aware of it in Delta County. We're an energy community. Of course, we have the coal mines, and we have a lot of natural gas, the drilling going on as well. And we need to include solar and renewables with that whole energy piece of the economy.
To explain the sometimes complicated technology of solar, they're using four stations, looking at sunlight orientation, basic wiring, solar cell technology.
And the last one's about energy efficiency, which is actually the most important key piece of solar. You have to have efficient. You have to be efficient with your energy before you ever think about putting solar. So that we drive that home. So the kids are here. They're early.
The buses pull up, and the bleary-eyed students unload and head out to their stations. Some chaperones get off the bus, too. Amy Treferin is from Hotchkiss, and she's here with her son. She says they are no strangers to saving electricity.
We do things like we unplug everything at home that's not being used, and we're very energy conscious. We hang all of our laundry, you know, little things like that that in the end really do make a big difference. And so I think being here helps him to see how that's a more of a global perspective. It's not just a little thing that we do at home. He's learning what it is that we're doing and why.
Amy says it's not a political stance, and she's not trying to make a statement. It's just about conservation.
The whole idea is to conserve and reuse our resources and be careful with what we have, regardless of what we feel politically. But yes, you're right. When you say solar panels, people definitely do think that you're some left-leaning hippie kind of person, and that's not true at all.
That political tension can especially be felt in the North Fork Valley. It's coal country, and it's seen jobs vanishing. Hundreds have been laid off in the past year, including 150 this week alone. Jim Frazier teaches 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th grade science class at Paonia Junior-Senior High School. He says that it's great for the kids to come out here and experience science hands-on, and he recognizes that talking about renewable energy in coal country isn't always easy.
Well, you know, in the classroom when you're talking about renewable energy and half your kids have parents working for the coal mine, they always bristle at first, but then when you talk about the science of it and treat it more as a science subject and not a political argument or debate, kids are willing to learn and they can gain a lot from it.
Just talking to his students for a few minutes shows how aware they are of what's going on.
Do you guys think that solar is going to be more prevalent when you guys are like 40 and 50?
Yeah, I think it will, especially on
like the war over coal and how much things are shutting down and how the world's just getting more efficient.
That's Paonia 8th grader Sackett McCall Chesnick, and he's more or less right. To learn more about the future of energy in the U.S., I talked with Christy Burr.
My name is Christy Burr. I'm currently an assistant professor at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and my field is in environmental and energy economics.
She says there's been a boom in solar adoption in the last decade, with the costs to make solar cells falling and governmental incentives to install it. There's been a big surge in solar panels in the U.S. But despite that, solar only makes up 0.2% of U.S. energy production.
Well, the reason why is that the total electricity production in the U.S. is 4,000 terawatt hour. So it's really tremendous amount of electricity that the whole country depends on. So even though solar has experienced this tremendous growth, but it's nowhere close to be able to provide the majority of electricity in the U.S.
And it's not just a matter of time issue either. Those tax rebates and other incentives are there for a reason.
Solar electricity is still quite expensive, even though we're saying that the cost of the system has been dropping so much over the last 5 to 10 years. The price of solar electricity is still about 4 to 5 times more expensive than, say, coal electricity. So you really need some additional support so that consumer will make this choice of switching.
But some costs are expected to fall in the future, and adoption in the U.S. and the rest of the world is expected to increase. 0.2% is not a lot, especially compared to Germany or Italy, with 10% of their power coming from solar. And with coal production being passed over for cleaner and cheaper natural gas, change seems to be inevitable. Back at SEI, Sackett says he thinks the solar is pretty cool and he might study it in college. For KVNF, I'm Jake Ryan.
That's it for the Regional News Roundup. To hear more local reporting, tune in weekdays at 8 a.m. and 5:50 p.m. for the Regional Newscast. You've been listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Patricia Naft. Stay tuned for As the Worm Turns, coming up next.